We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
We're really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
And yes, the financial sector has gotten a little bit out of hand. My goodness gracious. Who is going to take it on? What is it doing to our overall American economy? Remember when there was a middle class? Remember when Thomas Jefferson and other founders said that in order to have a Republican form of government, there has to be a strong middle class? It's been largely decimated in the past few years. Well, Bernie Sanders is running for president. Isn't that nice to hear? I like the sound of that. Bernie Sanders is running for president. And he has famously said that those banks that are too big to fail are also too big to exist. And he has just filed legislation to break up the big banks. Candidates like Hillary Clinton would never support such a bill, nor take on the clearly harmful concentration of wealth and power in America. But the power of big money in political discourse is really obscene and arguably has a deleterious effect on economic policy as a result. The power of big money has done great harm to our overall economy. People on the right traditionally complain about the debt. Yet it was this financial crisis of 2008 and the bailout of those biggest banks that nearly doubled the national debt and cost more than the Bush tax cuts and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan combined, somewhere between $13 and $14 trillion. That's beyond comprehension. And though some action has been taken to address the staggering costs of health care, which remain a problem, it remains a massive economic problem weighing down our economic recovery. Our guest today on Keeping Democracy Alive is Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Thank you for being with us, Gerald. Gerald Friedman is one of the nation's leading experts on the economics of healthcare. Friedman drafted the financing plans for single-payer healthcare system proposals of Colorado, Maryland, and Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and the U.S. government, and he has advised policymakers in Vermont on numerous economic issues. There's been some difficulty in making single-payer happen there, but his teaching and research interests focus on economic history, labor economics, and the history of economic thought. His most recent book, Reigniting the Labor Movement, Restoring Means to Ends in a Democratic Labor Movement, assesses the decline of the labor movement in advanced capitalist democracies. He's the editor of the Dollars and Cents Economic Crisis Reader. Friedman has been a regular correspondent on the international financial crisis and on Al Jazeera television and other media outlets. Well, again, thanks for being with us, Professor Friedman. Of all the presidential candidates, no question Bernie Sanders' economic proposals are the most radical in the sense that they get to the root, which is the definition of that word, radical, after all. There's a lot to talk about. Let's start with health care. We have the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, over which the right wing threw a fit. How much of an economic crisis is health care still, and how effective is the Affordable Care Act in terms of addressing the economic harm to the United States?
Well, it's not very effective at addressing the economic harm coming from rising health care costs because it does very little to address the cost of health care. I do want to add that it is leading to a large increase in health insurance. Maybe 16 million people have health insurance this year who would not have had it without the Affordable Care Act.
So it's good
if
for
not
them.
For the Supreme Court, that number would be well over 20 million.
Hmm.
So for the first time in 2 decades or more, the number of people without health insurance is actually declining substantially in the United States because of the Affordable Care Act. Also, the quality of health insurance is better for most people because of the Affordable Care Act. So that's all good. But that's the easy part, getting people access to health insurance. Getting people access to health care is more difficult because a great many people with health insurance don't, you know, have such high copays and deductibles that they can't really go to the doctor. And the long-term economic problem in America is that we spend more and more and more of our income on health care. We spend about twice as much. The share of our gross domestic product going to health care is twice as high as in other advanced capitalist countries, countries with more effective health care systems, that is, with longer life expectancy and lower rates of morbidity. And we spend over twice as much of our gross domestic product on health care now as we did in the 1970s.
Wow.
So we've had to take a pot of money greater than what we spend on the military. We've had to take that money from everything else that we do, from summer travel, from college, from K-12 education. We've had to take that money out of these other activities and pile it into healthcare with no sign that we're actually getting improved healthcare out of that. And the Affordable Care Act doesn't do anything about the cost size of healthcare. So it's, you know, it's a good thing.
Yeah. It helps those individuals.
It's not what we need.
So
Bernie Sanders is talking about what we need, a single payer plan which would control healthcare costs, provide access to everybody, and bring healthcare pricing under control.
So in terms of the overall economy and the economic problems, I don't know how it can be, you know, simplified, how, you know, there's propping up the banks, there's the military spending, there's a lot of aspects that really challenge the economy. I wonder, in simplest terms, how much healthcare, you know, adversely affects the strength of the American economy.
Well, it's hurting our economy in every way. I mean, when you're spending that much money on one activity, then, you know, you're obviously starving everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're talking about trillions of dollars spent on health care.
Mm.
That's money that's not available for other things. So that's the substitution side of it. The second piece is healthcare costs rise at 5-6% a year, while the economy grows at 2-3% a year.
Mm.
So we have to, you know, go back. And people, when you go into labor negotiations, you see this all the time. The first thing the employer says is, "Well, our healthcare costs are rising, so we need to cut your pay."
Mm.
You know, they don't always, not always so stark about it, but that's basically what they're saying.
Right.
School districts go to taxpayers and say, because of rising health care costs, we either have to raise taxes or we have to lay off teachers.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, these are the choices that everybody experiences in the American economy because of rising health care. And businesses experience this. You could locate your airplane factory in Ontario and save 10% of your payroll immediately because of lower costs of health care, because Ontario has a single-payer health plan.
Mm-hmm.
And while taxes are higher, the cost of health care is so much less than in Michigan or in anywhere in the United States. American businesses go into competition with their foreign rivals with one hand tied behind the back and a big weight on one ankle from the cost of health care. And that's costing us jobs, it's costing us tax revenue, and it's encouraging American businesses to invest elsewhere in the world. rather than in the United States, just to avoid the cost of health care.
And the power of the top brass at the healthcare companies is, it's really amazing, really remarkable. And when you talked about, you know, we can't increase your pay because healthcare costs more. Well, a lot of that money is going to the, you know, top floors, the people who are profiting tremendously from healthcare. And
it's contributing to rising income inequality.
Yeah.
Because basically what you're doing is you're assessing working people a fixed amount of money, you know, $18,000, $20,000, $25,000 for a family health insurance plan. I mean, you may not see that because
right.
so much of it is paid before you get your paycheck.
Right.
But you're paying it in lower wages. And that money is going to the inflated prices of health care in the United States. The higher cost of prescription drugs, which are 50-60% higher in the United States than in the rest of the world. And the higher cost of hospitals and medical facilities and medical devices, all of which goes to inflated incomes for the people who own these facilities. You know, even if they're nominally nonprofit,
right.
you see these multi-million-dollar contracts with CEOs of hospitals nowadays. I was once talking to a graduate student at an airport, of all places. And his father, he explains to me, is the only hospital director in the state of Wisconsin who earns less than $1 million because he works for the public hospital. He runs the public hospital in Milwaukee. And I didn't ask what his salary was, but he told me that his dad's close to $1 million. Yeah, but and the same for the health insurers.
Right.
Steve Helmsley at United Healthcare walked away with $28 million last year.
So we, the people, are subsidizing.
How many people did he cure of cancer
For
$28 million?
Absolutely amazing. And the political power that they have is phenomenal, not just over Republicans, but frankly, largely over Democrats, too. And that's where our friend Bernie Sanders is quite a bit different. He's actually having the chutzpah, if you will, to stand up to the power of the health insurance lobby. What has he supported in terms of really coming to grips with health care? What is so different about his proposal on that?
He supports a single-payer plan, which there are various different versions. In the House, there's H.R. 676, which is what I wrote about, and that's kind of the official single-payer bill. But basically, it would establish... it would expand the Medicare program to include all Americans, regardless of age, and to cover basically all your health care needs. And it would do it without the co-pays and without the premium associated with Medicare Part B or the Medicare Part D drug program. So you'd have basically everything covered. And it would be done administratively very simply. Everybody who goes to a doctor would just have their medical care covered. So it would cut out literally hundreds of billions of dollars of excess administrative activity that goes on in processing bills in American hospitals.
Oh, yeah. The overhead has got to be enormous for that stuff, whereas in places where there is single payer, the overhead, I understand, is like 2 or 3%.
Yes, exactly. The overhead in running the program, would be probably in the order of less than 2% compared to 15% or 12 to 15% for the current private insurance system. So that's going to be a savings of $200 billion right at the start. Also, there'd be another $300 billion in savings in physician offices and hospitals. The average American hospital has more people doing billing than they have beds. I can't imagine what they do. But if you look at a hospital bill, you understand.
It goes
on and on for pages and pages and pages.
Unbelievable. Well, if you
it's all just Well, just waste. I mean, none of this makes people healthier.
No,
you know,
for sure.
It helps you get out of the hospital and back on your feet sooner.
If you just tuned in, this is Keeping Democracy Alive. Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And, you know, it does, these costs absolutely do affect our democracy. What kind of a democracy is it where there's this tremendous income inequality where people don't have control over it? And it really very much adversely affects our Republican form of government and our ability to maintain a democracy. And it seems to me, Professor Friedman, that although the New Deal was a very long time ago and was unquestionably successful in creating jobs and saving the American economy, really saving American capitalism, that this is the real focus of 21st century Republicans. Their highest priority is to destroy any and all vestiges of the New Deal. Is this accurate? And how is this affecting our economy today and what they're talking about for economic recovery?
Well, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, because the New Deal didn't just create jobs, but the New Deal and the whole New Deal program of providing a social safety net for people and supporting unions that would give voice to workers at work and creating a form of economic democracy and pushing up wages. I mean, all this amounted to a massive redistribution of power in America.
Yes.
Away from the 1% or the 0.1%.
Exactly.
Towards common people. I mean, the New Deal was an expression of American democracy. And the growth of American democracy, the process that we saw through abolition of slavery, giving women the right to vote, universal public education, and then the New Deal, expansion of democracy into the realm of economics. And neoliberalism, you know, the policies that advanced by, you know, all the Republicans and many Democrats in Washington, amounts to a return to a pre-New Deal distribution of power, where you would have power on the basis of owning a lot of stuff. If you own the factory, you have power over everybody who wants to use the factory. If you own the real estate, you have power over people who want to live on your property. And we see this. There was a recent study by these political scientists, Gillens and Page, at Princeton, where they assessed some 4,000 policy proposals. And what they found is very little difference in the probability of whether a policy proposal would be enacted according to the attitudes of the great majority of the population. What matters is the attitude of the economic elite. Mm. If the economic elite wants something, then there's a pretty good chance it will be enacted. If they don't want it, it won't happen. That's what's been happening in America. And we're no longer quite a democracy. We're becoming a plutocracy.
Absolutely. And it seems to me, unless my history memory is wrong, that 1776, it was about gaining a self-government away from an economic elite calling all the shots. You know, I mean, and how people can call themselves conservatives and be for returning to that which we rebelled against in the War of Independence, it amazes me. And it does amaze.
Oh, they're not conservative, they're radical.
Absolutely. To me, when they call themselves conservative, they're not conserving anything. They're absolutely radicals. There's no question about it. And it amazes me that today's Republicans have the courage to still push trickle down as a way to create jobs. I mean, they've actually tried to rebrand the super rich. Instead of calling them super rich, they call them job creators. Wink, wink. Oh. How does such economic policy making really affect our economy, the middle class, and our democracy by you know, catering to them and pushing trickle down?
Yeah, well, it's we're in a completely new era in American economic history. If you look from, we have good data on wages and reasonable estimates of labor productivity going back to the 1790s. From the 1790s to the 1970s, 180 years, productivity grew at 1.5% a year. Wages grew at 1.5% a year. And they moved more or less together. There were periods like the 1920s when productivity grew faster than wages. And then in the New Deal era from the 1930s to the 1960s, wages grew a little bit faster than productivity. But basically, workers were working harder, being more productive, more skillful, and they were getting paid for it. This was kind of the Fordist deal. American business would pay people higher wages in exchange they would work harder, and they'd be more productive.
And it worked.
Since the 1970s, people continue to be more productive. Productivity can, you know, American workers are about twice as productive as they were 40 years ago.
Hmm.
What hasn't happened is wages. Wages haven't changed. You know, they went up a little bit in the 1990s when Clinton was president, and we had that little brief period of full employment in the late 1990s. But other than that, wages have been stagnant for, on average, for Americans, which means that for poor Americans in the bottom half of the economy, wages have actually been falling because there has been some increase in wages for college-educated people at the top. Instead, what's happened is most of the gains in productivity, instead of going to the workers who are doing the work, have been going to the people who own the means of production, the capitalists. And the share of American wealth owned by the wealthiest 30,000 people, that's 30,000 people, 10,000 households, 1/100 of 1%. People talk about the 1%, but it's not really the 1% who are gaining.
Right.
It's the 1/100 of 1%. And they now own about 14% of America. 10,000 households. The 400, the Forbes 400, own about 2% of America all by themselves.
And, you know, there was, I can't help but be reminded of that phrase, the Gilded Age in the 1890s. I don't really have a handle on, you know, how few people had what percentage of the wealth back then. But I wonder, you know, how that was dealt with, what the Gilded Age was really like. I'm guessing it's probably worse right now. What do you know about it?
Yeah. Now, the Gilded Age, the 1890s, the 1880s, 1890s, is notable because of a sharp uptick in the share of wealth owned by the richest people in a period of rising economic growth. We have a period of relatively stagnant economic growth, relatively little increase, and a sharp uptick in the share going to the rich.
Oh my.
The difference between then and now is in the Gilded Age, the rich were getting richer, but so was everybody else.
Hmm.
So the share going to the richest increased, but not as much as has been happening now. Now, the last 40 years, we've had relatively slow economic growth and a very sharp increase in the wealth going to the richest. So basically, the rich have been monopolizing the gains from economic growth over the last 40 years. That's different than the Gilded Age. And that's why the share of wealth going to the richest is probably at a higher level now than ever in American history.
Hmm.
Certainly ever since the end of slavery. You know, slavery was kind of a whole different system. But since 1865, we probably have the most unequal share of distribution of wealth. We also have a distribution of wealth that is remarkably unequal compared to other affluent countries. We're much less equal than Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy. You know, we're comparable to Russia, which is hardly a country you want to be similar to.
True.
And China. The United States and China together have close to half the world's billionaires.
Hmm.
10% of the world's billionaires live in New York City alone. Yeah, I mean,
oh, wow.
You know, it's like, that tells you something about, you know, the new Gilded Age. The difference between the old another difference between the old Gilded Age, the 1880s and 90s, and today, is that there's much less popular protest.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. I mean, how there was popular protest back then. Nowadays, it seems like people who are getting screwed by this system are some of the most supportive. They buy into the rebranding of the, you know, super rich as the job creators, and there's not a lot of protest now. And you know, the income inequality now is bigger than any other time. If you look at any kind of graph, it's just shocking to see it. What happened in the 1890s to bring that change? That's not happening now.
Well, the 1880s and 1890s had rising union membership, the growth, the very rapid growth of political movements against inequality, the populist, which kind of emerged in the 1890s as the Populist Party, which to some extent took over the Democratic Party. And there were massive popular, you know, uprisings, really, around Pullman in 1894, May Day in Chicago in 1886. Yes. And, you know, we did have Occupy, which was a huge movement across the country. But it actually was more an a protest than a movement. It didn't leave as much behind an institutional continuing protest as I might have hoped.
Yeah, well,
but
it changed the discussion.
It was deliberately anti-organization, so it didn't have a legacy.
Well,
and that's it. You know, otherwise, you know, if you look at American politics, the people who support the most conservative political movements, you're absolutely right, the strongest supporters of the most conservative, anti-working people politicians are from states and regions with the greatest poverty and the greatest economic need.
And the super rich depend on that. They depend on people believing that they're powerless. I find that very frustrating, but it does seem like there is somebody who is going to be giving voice to that, and that is Bernie Sanders. I think it's fair to call him a populist. They're going to try to brand him a lefty, but I think he is in the long-standing American populist tradition. And as a member of the, he's the ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee. He's looking at the budgets, and the Republican budget that's been proposed would throw 27 million Americans off health insurance, slash $5 trillion over the coming decade from programs that help working families, cut taxes on the super rich, actually cut taxes on the super rich, which is amazing to me, and at the same time, raise taxes on working families with kids, all while, of course, boosting military contractors spending by $38 billion next year. And in a Senate floor speech, Sanders called it, quote, an absolute disaster for the working families of this country. Is that going to connect, you think? And what do you think he means that might resonate with working families in America?
I would hope so. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that what's been missing in American politics in this Gilded Age compared to the old Gilded Age is a voice proposing an alternative economic program.
Right.
You know, there were alternatives offered then. Today, you know, I mean, I like Obama. There are a lot of things about the Obama administration I'm very happy with. But there's no alternative economic program there to neoliberalism. I mean, Obama's answer to inequality is everybody should go to college. I mean, that's just not it. You know, Obama never talks about unions. You know, he does talk about raising the minimum wage, which is a good thing. But what about everybody else? Everybody's above the minimum wage. You know, well, it will. Yeah, you hope it will trickle up, but and here we have Bernie Sanders. He's really offering something more, a complete alternative vision of an economy that will be regulated in the interest of creating jobs and raising wages. And he doesn't bring the racial baggage. You know, somebody once said to me, if you never know what to say in a political science discussion about the United States, you don't have an answer to a question, just say race, and that's going to work. Because race basically covers, you know, in some way affects everything. Voter disenfranchisement, incarceration rate.
Yes.
Why do poor people vote Republican against a black Democrat?
Right.
Okay, well, that's not going to be an issue with Bernie Sanders. He is Jewish, though, and
he
speaks with a Brooklyn accent. So,
I know.
Yeah.
I wonder about that.
Yeah, but at least he's not black. So, you know, like, maybe he'll be able to reach some of these people. I mean, you know, it's like the people who've been most anti-Obama, you know, in places like West Virginia, Kentucky.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I know there's coal as an issue, but it's
right.
The white South going down into Arkansas. You know, these are areas that voted for Clinton. You know, they were competitive for Kerry. And they're very heavily Republican now.
Oh, yes.
And these are the people who need government programs.
And
you know, in Kentucky, 3% get Social Security disability. You know, and then they support a Republican budget that slashes disability?
Well,
maybe Bernie can get through. Yeah.
Well, I think there is evidence that he has gotten through. He has gone down to places like Alabama and really connected with people. I have a theory here. It'll be tested soon, that a lot of the people, the like Southern whites and a lot of the people who have been drawn to the Tea Party have done so for what I think are legitimate reasons, you know, that they recognize that this is not government of, by, and for the people. This is government of, by, and for somebody else. And Bernie Sanders actually dares to talk about that. And you think about the people who are most screwed by the system right now of everything flowing to the top 0.01%. You think Hillary Clinton is going to connect with that? I don't think so. I can't imagine her even campaigning there. She's a part of the, she's not going to speak out against the unequal distribution of wealth and how much that really is a problem. I don't think people understand how big of a problem it really is. You know, it seems like, there's a few rich people, but, you know, everybody else is doing all right. And we just sort of sweep that aside. But one thing that I think may connect with people is something that not a lot of people have heard about. It's been kept secret on purpose, because if people really knew what's in the Trans-Pacific Partnership proposal, people would be outraged. Why do you think the president is doing this, Professor Friedman, and how would the Trans-Pacific Partnership affect America's economic strength? My understanding is Bernie Sanders has come out pretty clearly on that.
Well, yeah, I think most Democrats in the Senate and House have now come out against it. For Obama, this is his payback to the economic interests that have supported him.
Uh-huh.
We may think of Obama's campaign, his billion-dollar campaign, you know, was funded by my $200 contribution, and I don't know what you gave.
No, probably
but,
about
you know,
the same.
But now it was funded just like any other billion-dollar campaign is going to be funded. Hillary Clinton's going to be the same.
Of course.
By people writing big checks at Microsoft, Apple. These are the companies that support the Democrats. Hollywood.
Big money.
A certain amount of money. I mean, the big banks mostly go Republican. Wall Street generally goes Republican, but it always cuts in a big check to the Democrats also.
And they like Hillary.
And that's where the big money came from for Obama, as it came for Clinton.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, the price. They want access to foreign markets for their software, for their entertainment, and American drug companies want it for their drugs. Banks want access to foreign capital markets. And Trans-Pacific Partnership is just part, that's what they want. They're collecting on their campaign contributions.
The
Democrats in Congress can oppose it, because I think, you know, half of them are thinking it doesn't matter what I say. It will pass anyway, so nobody will get mad at me. This is why people get cynical.
Oh.
And this is why working people don't drop out and stop voting.
Right.
You know, I mean, even as important as these, poor people and working people in Kentucky voting Republican,
an even greater number just don't vote at all.
Right. They
so
believe
the gap between voting by rich and poor Americans has widened dramatically. Part of that is declining unions.
Right.
Unions traditionally mobilize people to vote. But the other part is the Democrats, you know, including Obama, are not, I mean, you know, I would make the case that Obama has done excellent, important things for working people. But, you know, it's been palliative. He hasn't addressed the fundamental problems which are leading to, you know, to stagnant wages and rising inequality.
Right.
And people know that. They say, okay, it's nice that we had extended unemployment insurance during the Great Recession. But, you know, the recession's over and we're still miserable.
And
we still don't have any decent jobs.
The idea...
And Obama doesn't have any answer to that.
No, he doesn't, because he, you know, there's the institutional Democratic Party, like the institutional Republican Party, and, you know, Wall Street, the top 100th of 1%, yeah, they prefer Republicans, but they're fine with the Democrats who aren't going to affect them at all, who don't want to talk about the income inequality. And people, of course, you know, people who are, they're, again, most screwed by it, they accept their powerlessness. It's been a specific intention by the super rich and powerful to make people believe we don't have power. And it's worked. It's absolutely worked. And one of the things that has really affected the economy, I believe, is the President Clinton's repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. Now, most people have no idea what that is. I can't imagine Hillary Clinton talking about reinstating something like the Glass-Steagall Act, but I'm sure Bernie Sanders is. How did that affect economy, and what is Bernie Sanders' position on that, Professor Friedman?
Well, Bernie Sanders wants to break up all the big banks on the logic that if your bank is so, or your financial institution
right.
is so big and has such systemic effects that we could not allow it to fail the way the Fed allowed Lehman Brothers to fail, then it needs to be broken up, because if you're too big to fail, then you will engage in reckless activities knowing that the federal government or the Federal Reserve will bail you out if things go bad. And that's basically where we are now. Because after the experience of what happened after the Fed let Lehman Brothers fail because they wanted to send a message to everybody else that you can't engage in reckless activity and assume you'll be bailed out. Instead, it completely backfired. And every large financial institution now feels that they can go and do anything they want and get bailed out because the Fed will never let anybody else fail after what happened with Lehman Brothers. So Bernie Sanders wants to break them up. That's good. I haven't heard, but I'm sure that he would favor some sort of return to Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall was part of the law that created federal deposit insurance. And what it did was it said, okay, we're going to insure deposits at banks. If we're going to insure deposits at banks, we want to make sure that the banks don't engage in reckless activity, because we're backing them up now. And the way to ensure they don't engage in reckless activity is banks will have to engage only in vanilla mortgage lending and other safe things. Well, mortgage lending was left to safe things and loans, but okay. You know, they weren't allowed to invest in stock equities and things like that.
Yeah, and highly speculative things.
Yes, they weren't allowed to speculate.
Yeah.
So that was the deal.
Yeah.
Now, the
banks.
Problem is, and Glass-Steagall was repealed in 98.
Thanks to Bill Clinton.
So that Bank America could buy an insurance company and basically go and engage in whatever reckless activity they wanted. And I opposed repeal, and I think we should bring it back, but it's a relatively small problem. Because most banking activity, and this is what the bank has said at the time, and they were right, that most banking activity is no longer being done by banks.
Right.
So the Fed and Glass-Steagall are regulating only a small part of financial action. And the real problem, and I'm sure that President Sanders will address this, although he hasn't said anything specifically, the real problem is to go after the shadow banking sector, which is regulated a little bit under the Dodd-Frank law, but the shadow banking, like GMAC, which became a bank, Allied Bank. And the other activities by industrial corporations that act like banks, or the whole hedge fund industry. You know, you set up in an office in New York, and you get, you know, rich people to give you money that you invest. That's still almost completely unregulated. And these are huge operations, bigger than the banking sector itself, and that still almost completely outside the regulatory apparatus. But if any of these go bad, as happened, you remember long-term capital management in 1997, I think it was?
Vaguely.
It was one of these hedge funds. It went bankrupt, and it was dragging for a couple days. It looked like it might drag down the whole Wall Street, and it was bailed out, even though it had no official banking status.
Wow.
And that's what we're dealing with now.
So we have
so Glass-Steagall would be good, but more important is to extend Glass-Steagall to Glass-Steagall type regulations to all of Wall Street.
So it does seem that the biggest financial interests are calling the shots. That's a plutocracy.
Yeah.
That's not a democracy. And we are on Keeping Democracy Alive. Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts. We're talking about Bernie Sanders, and I want to ask, you know, what the Republicans would do. I hate to paint this picture. What would you see happening to the economy if a Republican, and boy, what a bench they have this year, if a Republican wins the White House in 2016 and has a Republican Congress? Paint us a picture, please, what would happen to the American economy under that circumstance.
Oh, God. It's a frightening...
Please try. I know it's hard.
It would make me hope for an effective filibuster in the Senate, but I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, they haven't been real.
Yeah, there are enough Democrats who, you know, will break ranks. So there'll be another tax cut for the rich.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be attempts to completely privatize Social Security won't happen. Well, won't succeed. There'll be too much popular protest,
right,
as there was when Bush proposed it, but they'll chip away, as they have been chipping away at Medicare and Social Security for 20 years. Medicare especially, I mean, growing numbers of the relatively healthy elderly are moving into Medicare Advantage private plans, and there probably would be some sort of program for younger people going into Medicare with what Paul Ryan euphemistically calls premium support.
Cherry picking.
Where the feds will give you a certain voucher and you go buy your own insurance instead of Medicare.
So what,
I think that will that there'll be more of that to chip away at Medicare.
What would happen to what's left of the middle class in that scenario?
It will continue to deteriorate. I mean, we're seeing it all the time. And it'll just get worse. I mean, tax policy is moving more, and not so much under Obama, but the drift since Reagan, Bush, later Clinton, and then heavily under Bush, has been tax cuts for the rich,
right,
balanced to some extent by rising taxes in the form of Social Security taxes for working people in the middle class. So we're shifting the burden and, of course, rising state local taxes to make up for shortfalls in federal support. So we're seeing more and more the cost of government shifted onto the backs of working people, away from the rich, and we're seeing the benefits of government steered more and more, in the forms of health insurance payments, in the form of government subsidies to industry, government military spending going to rich people instead of working people. And we're going to see, we'd see a huge increase of that. And then, of course, there'd be assaults on women's right to choose, rights of people accused of crimes. The police would be, handcuffs would come off the police as if they're not already.
Yeah, really.
Just everything would get even worse. So much so that Democrats like Hillary Clinton, you know, come around and say, well, you know, I don't have to worry about people like Professor Friedman. He'll vote for me. He'll give me money.
Right. Lesser
because
of two
the
evils.
The alternative is so bad that the Democrats can move very far to the right and still keep everybody on the left.
That is, yeah, it's quite a prospect. And I think that people like Hillary Clinton would absolutely depend on that. Like, where else are they going to go? Back to the, you know, lesser of two evils. But I think one of the things I think that has appealed to many people who have gone to the Tea Party is they want something different. They want something that's not just a lesser of two evils. They want something that's not just a puppet of the plutocrats and talk about that. And, you know, the Constitution is there to protect our freedom, to protect our democracy, and to protect our Republican form of government. And we know that's a little hard to maintain. And one of the things that it seems to me is absolutely essential to have a government of, by, and for the people is an infrastructure. There has been so much less investment in schools and roads and bridges and airports and our energy infrastructure. It's been falling apart. But if Bernie Sanders were to become president, and I think it's possible because the media loves an insurgent, and he is going to be an insurgent, what would his kind of massive spending do? Would it? People are concerned that if there's this big massive stimulus spending, you know, real stimulus, would that not do great harm to our economy by spending all these things?
Oh, on the contrary, we have. I mean, the official unemployment rate is still over 2 percentage points above what it was in the late 1990s. And the real unemployment rate,
right,
which,
much higher.
You know, including discouraged workers,
right.
People working involuntarily, part-time,
mm-hmm.
That is, people who want full-time work but can't find it, is more like 12%. In many communities, especially communities of color, the unemployment rate is double that. So there are plenty of idle resources that could be put to work doing constructive things. And, God, there's plenty that needs to be done. It's been wonderful living in Massachusetts the last couple of years because the state has been investing heavily in solar energy. And so Massachusetts now has about the most efficient energy-wise, in terms of carbon emissions,
mm-hmm.
economy in the United States. We've passed California. That's really good. That's come because people have been hired to do it. There's plenty of work on building a solar economy, moving away from a greenhouse gas economy, fixing schools. I mean, God, where my sister, she's a social worker at an elementary school in eastern Massachusetts, a poor city. And, you know, for 3 or 4 months, she had a broken window in her office. She'd see students, and there was a breeze coming in through the window. Finally, in February, they fixed it. You know, it's like schools throughout the country need maintenance. They could be retrofitted to make them more energy efficient, which would save money, and it would reduce greenhouse emissions. It just needs somebody to hire the unemployed and the underemployed and put them to work doing this.
I find it fascinating.
And a green economy would produce millions of jobs. One of my colleagues here, Bob Polin, has estimates in the millions of jobs that would be created by transferring money from tax cuts or from military spending to green activities.
And, you know, it's pretty well agreed that the biggest stimulus that brought us really out of the depression of the 1930s was the massive spending on the war. There was certainly help from the New Deal. And now we have a massive spending public works program called military contractors, the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And it's huge spending. And yet Republicans and people on the right and many Democrats as well say, oh, you can't have big government like that. You can't have, you know, investments in you know, public works and in our infrastructure because that would be big government. What's your response to that? Do you think people are ready?
Oh.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, well, you just said it. I mean, big government is not a problem for these people when they're spying on our emails.
Yeah.
Big government is not a problem for these people when we're arresting millions of Americans for smoking a joint
really?
Of marijuana. Big government only becomes a problem when it's hiring people to do useful things. I mean, that's absurd. I mean, you're absolutely right about the war, but keep in mind that the New Deal reduced the unemployment rate by over two-thirds between 1933 and 1937 before they had a mistaken fiscal policy.
Yeah.
But it did that with the Public Works Program,
mm-hmm.
the Works Project Administration, which built high schools and other facilities throughout the country.
We need them.
Public Works Administration, the CPA, and the
all those alphabet
other programs. It built the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah,
that was
a good investment.
Conservation Corps project under the New Deal, and that's how we got out of the Great Depression.
Absolutely.
Even before World War II.
Yep.
Public works spending. That's exactly the kind of thing that Bernie Sanders is talking about. And it would not only give jobs to people who are unemployed or underemployed, but by creating a floor under the labor market, it would push up wages for all Americans and begin to address the problems of inequality that we have.
Interesting.
And by providing guaranteed employment for people,
right.
it would make it easier for workers to stand up for their rights and demand the right to collective bargaining and to speak up at work.
And you can see why the right wing opposes that. Now, as the campaign goes on, it's just barely getting started, and his insurgent effort gains steam. Of course, we can expect all kinds of nasty things to be said about Bernie and his proposals. Would his programs threaten capitalism itself? What do you think? People are going to say that.
No. I mean, capitalism is an amorphous thing. It can handle lots of compromises. We had capitalism in the 1950s and 1960s with strong labor unions. Germany, France, Italy, these are all capitalist economies with strong labor organizations, with government regulation of all sorts of economic activity. These are all capitalism. And we would and Canada has capitalism with single payer health insurance. We could have everything Bernie Sanders is talking about. We'd still be capitalists.
Right.
What we would be is we'd be full employment capitalists. It would be a capitalism where everybody is getting a share of the gains from economic growth instead of it all going to a few rich people. We'd be a safer capitalism because, where only a few people have a lot of money. That's a very unbalanced economy. That has what Marxists would call a realization problem, or what Keynesians would call a problem of effective demand. Because, how many cars can a few people buy? Those 10,000 super rich families, I mean, how many cars do they have? If everybody in the family has two cars, you have 60,000 cars? That's not enough to maintain, the big three automakers. They need millions of people buying cars. And for that, we need shared prosperity. And capitalism can have shared prosperity. And that's what Bernie Sanders is talking about.
And it seems to me Bernie Sanders' ideas would actually stimulate demand. And it seems to me also that you got to have demand.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's one of
there's a reason why 1929 and 2007 happened. These economic crises came at a peak of inequality, because those were times when we had crises of effective demand, because, like I said, those few rich people, they just can't consume enough to keep the economy going.
That's true. Well, hopefully we can have a stronger economy. And I know I always like to point listeners to websites at the end of the show. I know one website is bernie.org. You can check out. I don't know if there's any others you'd suggest, Professor Friedman.
I believe there's a BernieSanders.org of the official campaign website.
Oh, there is, yes. I believe it's
BernieSanders.com. Sorry, Bernie Sanders for President.
Well, just Google Bernie Sanders. Professor Gerald Friedman, Professor of Economics, University of Massachusetts, Amherst. There is some degree of, dare I say, reason for hope. I know hope was used before, but now...
Yeah, I'm all for hope. That's what's been missing. we need hope.
We
do. Optimism is foolish. Optimism gets disappointed, but hope we always need. Yeah.
We can have real change. Thanks so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive with Bert Cohen. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Revolution.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Alright. You say you got a real solution. Love to see the plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all do what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait. All right. All right. All right. Say you change the constitution. Institution, well, you know, you better free your mind instead. But if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't gonna make it with anyone anyhow. Don't you know it's gonna be all right, all right.